Today we have Steve Ray. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by Stephen Ray, who has authored a number of books, three of which I own. One is Upon This Rock, a book which helped my own brother come into the faith. He has a commentary on John, which sits typically near my nightstand. And now a new book, a commentary and Bible study on the book of Genesis, something which tragically is one of what? One or two in the Catholic world? There should be many more. So, Steve, thanks for joining me today.
Well, it's great to be here. Looking forward to all this discussion. And thanks a lot for inviting me, Jake.
Well, I'm a big fan of the books that you're spitting out, so I want people to know about them. First off, am I right that there's no other or few other Catholic commentaries on Genesis right now?
Let me say there's no standalone books on Genesis, because there are series of books or one volume Bible commentaries, but for my knowledge, if you went on Amazon and looked for a Catholic standalone book on Genesis that's come out, maybe a little pamphlet or something, but something that really deals with it comprehensively, I don't think there is one. If there was, I would have used it as a reference in mine, but I didn't find any.
Gotcha. Well, I'm looking at page 434 is the very last page. I have no idea how you stopped there. There is so much to say about Genesis. I think we share one thing, and that is it's also my favorite book. And my second favorite book is the Book of John.
So those are the two I've written on.
Yes, that's why I own them. I joke that if somebody stole the rest of the books out of my Bible, not only would I not be that upset, I honestly probably wouldn't notice for a while, because I'm probably in one of those two books. After that, it might be Exodus and Luke. I've done a lot of work in Leviticus and maybe some of the letters of Paul and Hebrews and whatnot. But yeah, Genesis and John I see as a beautiful pair. So if you want to get a set, John certainly has a bunch of callbacks to Genesis, particularly in that beginning, right? He's echoing Genesis purposefully. I'm curious why you also seem to be a big fan of those two books.
Well, I think they're both, if you ask me what are the two most important books of the Bible, I'd say Genesis and John. First, because Genesis gives you the whole beginning of everything. It's the foundation for all the rest of Scripture. So you can't understand the rest of the Bible without first understanding Genesis, because it is integral to everything else that happens. And the book of John, of course, is because I think that's the most profound gospel explaining who Jesus is. And he refers even below the surface, I should say, that spiritually wise, if you read John with Genesis in mind, it's just a profound book. So Genesis is probably the most beautiful presentation of Jesus being God in the flesh, come to save us from our sins. So if you had Genesis and John, you'd be in good shape, even if you didn't have the rest of the Bible, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And if you have Genesis as that core, it really does explain so much of the Gospels. I recently, I teach RCIA at my church, and we were going through last week the Old Testament covenants. And I began by telling the punchline of a joke. And of course, you know, nothing really comes from that. And then backtracking to the setup of the joke. I'm like, that's what we're doing when we read the Gospels and focus on the New Testament without first understanding where this came from, how this was set up, what was foreshadowed. It's like reading the punchline of a joke.
I'll just give you one quick example of how those two work together. In the book of John, you have Jesus on the cross with the water and the blood coming out of his side. And John tells you that this event took place in a garden. In John, it says that the tomb and the cross were in a garden. What a weird place to have a gallows or an electric chair, you know, where you execute people in a garden. But John wants you to know that. And in fact, if you miss it, he comes along later and says, who did Mary Magdalene mistake Jesus for at the tomb? She mistook him for the gardener. What was Adam in the first garden? He was a gardener. So if you look at this, Jesus is on the cross and blood and water is coming out of his side, and it's in a garden. John wants you to think about gardens. The prototypical garden is the Garden of Eden. What happened in the Garden of Eden? The first Adam is at a tree of life and he needs a bride. So God puts him to sleep, cuts open his side, takes part of his body out, and fashions it into a bride. He wakes up and says, oh my goodness, how beautiful she is. Now, Jesus is the last Adam. We know that from 1 Corinthians 15. So here we are in a new garden at a new tree, but this is the tree of death. It's reversing everything. And God has the new Adam in a garden at a tree, and he needs a bride. So he puts him to sleep on the cross. He cuts open his side with a lance, takes a blood and water, and fashions from that a church, the bride. Jesus wakes up and he loves his bride, the church. John writes this way. He expects you to think this way, and it's all based on the Old Testament, especially Genesis.
It's incredible how beautifully everything fits together, even though it was written by numerous authors over thousands of years in multiple languages. Everything syncs so perfectly in ways
it has to be. It has to be. There had to be a conductor, didn't there?
It seems like there might have been. I'll throw one in that I love about what you're talking about with the cross and the blood and the water coming down is in Leviticus. Yes, it talks about the burnt offerings. And Jesus fulfills each one of those sacrifices, but I love the way that he fulfills this one, because with that, they actually open up the animal and they wash the entrails and the internal organs. So the blood and water is coming out of the inside cavity of this. And it says they wash the internal organs and the legs. So with Jesus up on the cross, as that water comes out of his side, it's water washing through his internal organs and down his legs, fulfilling the burnt offering sacrifice, which in a lot of rabbinic texts, they say that the goal of doing this is to show how God ultimately wants to not just clean us on the outside, but renew our innermost being. And that's what Christ affects at the cross, particularly in the institution of those two sacraments, which are being pictured, the blood and the water coming from his side.
Yep. Definitely a conductor.
Oh,
those 73 books of the Bible, because you could never have come up with the intricacies with a committee. It had to be the Lord did that.
Anybody who's ever been part of a committee. Well, let's jump into Abraham. I wanted to give people a little bit of a teaser of what's in this book. So we're not going to spill all the beans in what's in here. Some of it you're going to have to get the book for. But Abraham, I want to hear a few of your thoughts. I think oftentimes we read in the New Testament how important he is. We see how often he's referenced. He's referenced many times in the Catechism by the fathers. But a lot of people are confused. What did he do? What was it about his life that made him such a core, pivotal, seminal figure in the life of the people of God? What's special about him?
You mentioned the number of times he's used. I love numbers in the Bible. Abraham is mentioned 324 times in the Bible. Wow. Sarah is mentioned 79 times. Between the two of them, they're mentioned 62 times in the Catechism. That's an unprecedented number of times. I dare you to find anybody other than Jesus that's mentioned more than 324 times, or even 62 times in the Catechism. But anyway, Abraham is a very seminal figure. God created, and then Adam and Eve sinned, and then he started over again with Noah. And the Jews refer to Noah as the second Adam, because he's starting humanity over again, and God gives him the same command to go out and multiply and fill the earth. But even right with Noah, he gets drunk and causes problems, and the sons came in. That's another whole story I deal with in here in the book. And sin just is rampant, and death is now in mankind, separation of man from God, separation from man and man, and separation even from within men, their own psychological, and they're split. Death means separation, and it just permeated the creation. So I think what happened is God is looking for a man to start over with. He wants to start a new covenant. He wants to start to prepare for his plan of restoration, to bring his son. He's going to drop his son in behind enemy lines, kind of as a guerrilla warfare thing, where he's going to bring back, redeem his creation. So he finds a man named Abram way over in what's Iraq of today. You know, people think of Abraham that he's a Jew, an Israelite. No, he's not. He was not any of those things. In fact, Israel comes from the name given to his grandson, Jacob. He's named Israel. Jew comes from the name Judah, which is his great-grandson, Judah. So he's neither an Israel, he's not a Jew. He is actually called a Hebrew. So God finds this guy, and he's going to build on him, but he's going to test him along the way. And boy, does he ever test him. At least 8 times he tests Abraham. And Abraham passes with flying colors, although he's not perfect, and Sarah is not perfect, but they make a few mistakes here and there. But overall, God, the whole book of Genesis, I make the comment that God draws straight with crooked lines. I know that's kind of a trite saying, but he really does. He takes sinful, flawed human beings, and he makes a straight line with them. He fulfills his purpose even using evil. The devil must hate it, because when he does something and he claps his hands and says, boy, did I ever mess up God, he only finds out that God used what he did for his own good. So Abram is, and his name is Abram, not Abraham. That doesn't happen until later. And Abram means father, and it's a cruel name, because he has no kids. And at 75 years old, he's living in Ur, U-R, that's how it's spelled, U-R, in Iraq of today, and he has no sons, no children, and his name is Father. So God comes and speaks to him and calls him and tells him, I want you to go to a place. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to give you a son. And Abraham's thinking, I'm already 75 years old. My wife is 65. How are we going to have a son? And where do you want me to go? He said, so now he's traveling. Janet, so now he's traveling all this way. He's going to have to go 1,600 miles. And this is a long way. And when you're traveling with flocks and herds, the understanding is that during that traveling, you cover basically 6 miles a day. Now, if it's you and me walking together, we cover 20 miles a day. This is average miles per day that we know from ancient times. So you could travel 20 miles a day, but when you're with herds and flocks and baby sheep and things, you can only travel about 6 miles a day. So do the math. 1,600 miles by 6 miles a day. But Abram, God comes to him, and he's in this opulent land of Ur. You know, I've been there. All the places in Genesis mentioned, I've been there. And Ur, there's a book called The Treasures of Ur, and it was an opulent city, wealthy, gold, silver, wonderful place to live. Big, huge pyramids called ziggurats, and they worshiped God. By the way, Abram didn't worship the living God up until 75 years old. His family worshiped Nana, the god of the moon. And they, in Joshua, book of Joshua says, your fathers on the other side of the river, they served other gods. God comes to Abram and says, I want you to go to this place. Now, if it was you or me, I would have said, okay, you know what? I'll do this, God. I'll follow you, but I want to know I want the deed to the land in advance. I'd like it signed. I want to know what kind of pension I'm going to have in my health insurance, and will there be a place for me to live there? And we would have ask God to give us all of these assurances ahead of time. But Abram just left. I'm just going to quote a few lines from one of my favorite poems. Abram talking to God when God tells him to go. Abram, you can imagine him saying, I'm supposed to scuttle my life upon a road to some mumbled nowhere. In 10 generations since the flood, you've spoken to no one. Now, like thunder on a clear day, you give commands. Pull up my tent. Desert my home, the graves of my ancestors. You come late, Lord. You come very late. But my camels will leave in the morning. That just gives me goosebumps every time I read that. Abram is just willing to go, even with all of that. And that's why he's the father of faith and not me.
You know what I've noticed about him is just... we've done a couple episodes on different key figures in Genesis. I kind of have a What They Didn't Tell You About series, yeah, where we pull from Jewish sources. And I explicitly say, I'm telling you everything I can find, not everything I'm sure about. So it's a little bit more speculative. So we'll dig into some of the Jewish tradition and whatnot. So we've done a few dives in that. What I've noticed is there's a physical movement which is going on in Genesis. As soon as Adam is kicked out of the garden, he's kicked out east. And then when Cain messes up, well, he's kicked out further east. And then we see two things going on. That the characters in the story are moving farther and farther east, and also they're just going up and down, but generally going down in their ability to sacrifice. Adam fails to sacrifice himself. Then God kind of stoops down and says, all right, sacrifice animals. Cain fails to sacrifice an animal. Then we get to, you know, the Tower of Babel, where they've dipped negative. They're actually using the stuff of the earth not a sacrifice to God, but to elevate themselves, and they get cursed, and we have the flood and all that terrible stuff. But with Abraham, something different happens, and it really is a turning point. And that is, he's found, like you said, so far away from where Eden was, so far away from the promised land, but he backtracks physically, and he seems to be backtracking spiritually, where he sacrifices his own ambitions, his own country, his own old religion. Then he starts making altars to God. And the sacrifices that he does keep on getting better and better and better until he's with the sacrifice of Isaac, the meal with Melchizedek. So he's like backtracking through all of the terrible stuff that happened in Genesis and returning at this breakneck speed, both physically and in the order of worship.
Yeah, he really is a remarkable character, and he does start something brand new where all the others fell. He moves forward, and God chose him because he was willing to do that. And, you know, he leaves Ur and goes all the way to Canaan. What's funny about this is that in 586, when Israel rebelled against God and he sends them to Babylon, it's kind of, you know, when you play the game Monopoly, you always have to go back to go.
Yep.
And this is what happened. God says, I brought you into this beautiful land. I gave it everything to you, and you screwed up and you kept resisting to me. So now go back to go all the way back to Babylon, where your father came from, Abraham, and we're going to start over again.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
And now they have to work their way all the way back to the land of Israel again. But that's his punishment for them. And so Abram is really quite the figure who is willing to obey God and do these things and uproot his whole life. And then he gets to the land of Israel. And I just got back from Israel about 3 days ago, and I've been there over 200 times. And when we're driving with our groups down into the Judean wilderness, out of the mountains of Jerusalem, down there's Bedouin tribes all along down in the Judean wilderness. There are the tribes of Bedouins with their sheep and their goats. And I always say, people, okay, look out the window, see that tribe of Bedouins out there. You're looking at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's them right out there with their sheep and goats. And they traveled for 25 years. They followed the seasons. They went up into the hills during the summer when it was the grass was better up there, and down into the valley at other times. And, you know, these were rugged people. If you go out and look at the Bedouins today and the people out in the deserts, they don't have all their teeth. They're very rugged people. They don't take baths and showers. They don't have dentists. And, you know, we always see all these people with perfect pearly white teeth, like in The Chosen, the movies. And then, but these guys, people don't realize what it was really like to live out there like that. I spent a day with the Bedouins out there when I was filming. I did a movie called Abraham, the Father of Faith and Works, where we went to Iraq and we went up into Haran, and which is Turkey of today, and all through the Palestinian areas. And we spent a day with the Bedouins, getting the filming so I could get an idea of what Abraham's life was really like. And even out there today, those Bedouins only have half their teeth and the other ones are brown, and their kids don't go to school, and they're not clean because they don't have baths and showers. And, you know, we have this idealized American view of all of these saints from the Old Testament, the New Testament, even it wasn't quite like that. I wanted to spend the night out there with the Bedouins just for the feeling, the sense that my wife says, no way. She said, no way we're doing that. She said, I spent the day out there. That was enough for me. but she's a great wife going all these places with me. But the real daily life of these people is something we can't even begin to comprehend.
You know, it amazes me that when you read through the Bible, you think, oh, God's here, God's there, God's speaking, God's peering, God's doing this, God's doing that. But when you think about like the life of Abraham, that's not what happened. It's he lived a huge amount of his life, the majority of his life, and God had not spoken to him yet. And then he appears, and then he's gone for I don't know how long. You probably know off the top of your head, but a long time in the Old Testament. From the time he's first told to leave to the next time God shows up. So the majority of his life is that ordinary Bedouin lifestyle.
Yep. And that's exactly correct. He was out in the wilderness, it says, wandering for 25 years, waiting for the son to come. Never got a son. Waiting for to own the land. He never owns an inch of the land. He only owns a field called Machpelah, so that he could bury his wife Sarah when she died. That's the only bit of land he ever owned. And in Genesis 15, God comes to him in a dream, and it's a very dark dream and scary. And he says, your descendants, you're not going to own this land, but that'll be for your descendants. But your descendants will go into another land and be slaves there for 400 years. And they will come back, and then they will inherit the land. So even Abraham, God made this promise to him, and Abraham never got the fulfillment of the promise, except for his son. And then the promise with the son was that they would then get the land in 400 years. And why, here's just a real quick one. Why was that land so important? Why did God give him that land? We jokingly say on a pilgrimage that he gave him the only land in the Middle East that doesn't have any oil. Why would he give him that land? Because he was giving him the bridge between the great civilizations. All of the spice routes and all of the merchants and the caravans are traveling between Egypt and the Hittites up in the European area, and Egypt over to Babylon and Assyria. Everywhere you went, you had to pass through Canaan, which became known as the land of Israel. So God gave them the bridge. When you own the bridge, you own the tollway. And so this was the prime piece of land that he gave to Abraham. That's why there's been so many wars and fighting, because everybody wants that bridge between the great civilizations. So Abraham gets that. Now for 25 years, he's wandering around in the wilderness, and he's following his sheep and herds. And his wife gets antsy, and she said, I don't have a son yet, so let's use my maidservant. And the laws of the land were at the time that if a woman could not have a son, she could use one of her servants. And they were slaves. Let's face it. Back in those days, they owned human beings. And she owned Hagar. And she said, I want you to lie with Hagar and have a baby. And then what happens is they would, when the baby was born, it would be placed on the woman, the matron's lap, and that would be a form of adoption. It would become her son. So that's what Sarah said. I'm tired of waiting. I don't know that this is going to happen. So why don't we have a son through my maidservant? And that then we got Ishmael, which is the father of the Arabs. But that wasn't God's plan. But that was, Abraham did what Sarah said, and that was a moment of not trusting, a moment of doubt. So even though he's the father of faith, there was times where he fell. But then God finally came in chapter 18. And this is a very interesting passage, because there are three visitors, travelers, who appear at the entrance of Abraham's tent in Hebron. And I've gone to the place in Hebron where this happened. Most people have never seen it or been there, called the Oaks of Mamre. And there's a place there where Herod built a big building over top of the altar of Abraham that he built there. And later, Constantine built a church there. Now, most people never, ever see that. It's in our movie. We went there. We found it. And so at that point, then these three travelers come, and there are three individuals, but he addresses them, Abram, as a singular Lord. And the fathers of the church, especially Ambrose and Augustine, I put this in a lot of this in my book, say we're treading deep waters here, because how can we not see the Trinity? So it seems as though the Trinity appears to Abraham and comes to talk to him. And they say, while they're eating their dinner, and Abraham is very hospitable. He says he rushed to do this and he ran to do that. And he quickly got the fatted calf. And Sarah has cooked and prepared all this food, but then she's in the tent because men and women don't really associate. Even when they travel, men and women travel separately in caravans. So Sarah stays in the tent. Abram's out talking with these three, and they say, your wife Sarah will have a baby this time next year. And Sarah laughs. She laughs in the tent, and they heard her, and they said, why did Sarah laugh? And she came out and said, I didn't laugh. And he said, yes, you did. We heard you laugh. She got caught. But a year later, guess what? She did have a son. And that son was Isaac, and his name means laughter. And now Abram has this wonderful son, the fulfillment at 99 or 100 years old. He finally gets the fulfillment of this promise from God that he would have a son. Now Abraham's name is changed from Abram, which means father, to Abraham, which means father of nations. But now he's only got one son, but he knows through that one son, the promises that God gave him will be fulfilled. Even though he doesn't see the land, he doesn't own the land, he knows that through that son, the promises will be fulfilled that God had given him.
Awesome. Now, what is there any particular thing that makes you see the Trinity specifically instead of, say, you know, often we hear the angel of the Lord goes here or there. And some people view that as that could be a Christophany, that could be God coming in some way. Other it people is. Say, well, maybe that's yeah. just an angel that represents God. For instance, you know, Gabriel comes to speak the words of God to Mary. So they seem to be called angels there. But how would we know, or what evidence would we have that this is like the Trinity coming? Or how exactly do we work that out?
It's the angel of the Lord. For example, in the bush, the burning bush, when Moses first saw it, it was God that spoke to him. He said, my name is I am. And later it's referred to as the angel of the Lord who spoke to Moses. So it's very clear. Also in the book of Genesis, again, Jacob wrestles with a man all night long.
Right.
And he says, bless me. And there is a blessing. And he changes his name to Israel, one who wrestles with God. He had wrestled all night with God. And he calls the name of the place Penuel, which means I have seen God face to face and I've lived. So when you hear of the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, and it also happens with Joshua when they're traveling to go against Jericho, he comes up against a soldier with a sword. And he said, who are you? He said, I am the captain of the Lord of hosts, which is again a theophany of revelation of probably the pre-incarnate Christ is what it is. So when you have these three appear to him in the book of Genesis, it's he calls them singular Lord, and yet there are three. And the most famous icon ever painted, or you don't paint, you write an icon, I'd be precise, but the most famous icon of all time is by Rublev. It's in Russia, and it's called the Trinity, and it is an image of these three visitors with Abraham dressed as angels. And it's also, they're called Yahweh. That's the name of God refers to them. And two of them then decide to go down to Sodom, and one of them leaves. And then when you get down to Sodom, when they call down fire, it's the same ones that were there with Abraham, only two of them now, but one went is gone. It says in the book of Genesis that, and Yahweh on the earth called down fire from Yahweh in heaven. So it appears that if they were the Trinity, the Father went back to heaven. The other two persons of the Trinity went down to Sodom, and those called Yahweh called down fire from Yahweh in heaven. And the fathers of the church says, how can we not see the Trinity here?
Awesome. Because a lot of, you know, our Jewish friends would be very skeptical. I think you gave some very good reasons to show that when it's saying the angel of the Lord, that in other contexts, and I really like the one that you brought up with Jacob, shows that no, that is God. So I think that's a great thing to bring up when we're dialoguing with Jewish friends.
the book of Genesis also, the writer obviously didn't know about the Trinity yet, because that hasn't been revealed, all the revelation of the Trinity, what we now have is in the church. Mm-hmm. But there are these mysterious passages of creating, and it says, God says, let us make man in our image. Who's the us? Well, some have said it's the divine majesty, where a king would say we, when he's referring to his royal prerogatives, or that the angels, maybe he's saying we, referring to the angels, but never anywhere in scripture are the angels involved in creation. That is an act of God alone. So when God says we should make man in our image, there's an allusion there to the Trinity. So all the way through the Old Testament, there is these allusions, but then it becomes a full revelation once you get to the New Testament. And by the way, in the Old Testament, God is presented as one God. And the Jews and the Israelites, they just keep being seduced by all the multiple gods of the nations around them. And by the way, when you say the God of Israel, back in those days, you viewed God as being tied to the land. So the God Moloch and Chemosh were the gods of Ammon and Moab. The God Baal is the god of Phoenicia and the Canaanites. The God of Israel is the god of the people that live in that land. So it's kind of perceived that this God is kind of restricted to this land of Israel. God is the God of Israel. But what's cool about this is that he goes all the way to Iraq to choose a man. And then when they're in the land of Egypt, this God of Israel isn't stuck in Israel. He goes all the way down to Egypt to deliver them. And he destroys the gods of Egypt in the process. So this, the whole idea of the book of Genesis is that this God is the God above all the other so-called gods. He's not restricted to a geographical area. He can go anywhere he wants because he made it. And so this is a whole different concept of God that the book of Genesis is revealing, that was understood by all the peoples and the nations around.
Awesome. And, you know, when we get into the period of Hellenization right before the first century, that whole area, we get the whole two powers in heaven idea beginning to pop up amongst, Jewish scholars, where, I mean, this is part of their tradition, that there is something going on with the one God, which means there could be more persons than just one, the Father. So I think that the Trinity is certainly baked into scripture, but it also begins to bubble up through tradition prior to the first century.
Yeah, there's a lot of mysteries in the Old Testament that the Jews had to struggle with. For example, when Malachi says about the sacrifice, that there will come a time where the Gentiles will offer a pure sacrifice from east to west. You know, back in those days, all the sacrifices had to be made in Jerusalem, and only by those from the tribe of Levi, the line of Aaron, the high priest. And yet, in Malachi, the last prophet of the Old Testament said there's going to be a new sacrifice. It's going to be celebrated by the Gentiles, and it's going to be a pure sacrifice accepted by God from east to west around the world. And the fathers of the church said, bingo, that's the Eucharist. And
right.
So the whole Old Testament is alluding to all of these things. They're giving us one of the reasons when the Eucharist comes, you should look back and say, oh, of course, there it all is in the Old Testament. There's the showbread in the temple. There's the manna. There's the Passover lamb. All of these things were preparing us. And same thing for the Messiah. All of the things in the Old Testament are preparing us. The Jews should not have had blinders on their eyes. They should have seen it more than anybody else, because the Old Testament was their book. They should have seen all of this and recognized it when it finally came. And the whole story of Abraham. I hope we get time to talk about the sacrifice of Isaac.
let's jump right to that. I will throw in that one sacrifice that's pure, that's offered among the Gentiles, that has got to be the one sacrifice which is the only one that continues in the Messianic age, which was, to my knowledge, unanimously known to be the Thanksgiving, or was it the Todah sacrifice? So, I mean, there it is. That's Thanksgiving sacrifice, Greek Eucharist.
I'm giving talks all over the country this year on the Eucharist, and one of the two talks I give, one of them is called "Is the Mass Really a Sacrifice?" Mm-hmm. And I conclude by saying that even the Jewish rabbis would say that sacrifices and offerings of the Old Testament, at when the Messiah comes, they will all be culminated into one. The Mass is a culmination of all of the sacrifices of the Old Testament. They're all culminated into one. And the Jewish rabbis, anybody can Google Todah sacrifice. They will say, they said and have said to rabbis, that when the Messiah comes, all of those other sacrifices will be done away with, and there will be only one sacrifice left, the Todah sacrifice. The word Todah means in Hebrew thanksgiving, and therefore the word Eucharist means thanksgiving. So what happens here is that this is the sacrifice of the Eucharist is that Todah sacrifice. The Messiah has only brought one sacrifice, and here it is.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump into the sacrifice of Isaac, because talk about things which foreshadow the death of Christ. This one's the big one. So if you want to lay out a little bit about what was going on here.
Yes. This is an interesting one because it's just fascinating. I'm going to move to another room here real quick. So just give me a minute.
Oh, go for it.
Okay. I got window washers here and there. You hear me okay still?
We see through a glass darkly. Yep.
Yes. And so I'm going to go into another room here so I can talk to you while they're washing our windows.
Oh, wonderful.
This wasn't planned ahead of time. So, okay. So I'll carry on now. I'm in the other room. This sacrifice is, we call it the sacrifice of Isaac, but the Jews don't. And I think they're much more precise. I like the way they say it better. They call it the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, because he wasn't sacrificed. He was intended to be sacrificed. Abraham intended to do that, I think. Maybe he didn't. We'll get to that in a minute. But it's called the Akedah, the sacrifice, or the binding, the offering of Isaac, but although it wasn't actually done. So this is the pinnacle of the whole book of Genesis. In my book on Genesis, I make this the pinnacle of the whole thing. So you see that this is where the everything comes to a head. And because it's the pinnacle, the head of everything, it's also amazing that it's a picture of God the Father offering his son. So all of this is culminated here in Genesis chapter 22, and it's the final test of Abraham. Abraham has been tested over and over again. He gets in the land. He has to go to Egypt because there's a famine. He doesn't have a son for 25 years. He's tested by being told to circumcise himself. All of these things were tests that he had to do, but this is the final test. This is really the ultimate test, and in my book, I spend more time on this chapter than any other, and it's the whole pinnacle of the story. And here we go. It says in the beginning of that chapter 22, and God appeared to Abraham and said, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham responded with, here I am, Lord. By the way, in the Old Testament, anytime you want to respond to God correctly when he calls you, or if God ever does call you, make sure that you respond this way, here I am, Lord, because that's the way all of the great saints of the Old Testament responded when God called them, here I am, Lord. Mm-hmm. So then God says, Abraham, take your son, your only son whom you love, and offer him on Mount Moriah as a burnt offering, a holocaust. Now, just stop for a minute and think, how would you receive that? You have waited for 100 years for this son. All the promises that God has made you for 25 years, and now let's say Isaac is at least 15 years old. There's this speculation that he might have been older among the Jewish rabbis, but let's say he's at least 15, 17 years old. He had to be old enough to carry the wood of the fire up to the top of Mount Moriah. That's not something a five-year-old could do. So he obviously is a strapping young man called a lad, and in Hebrew, the word lad means a young man, a young adult man. So he says, take your son, your only son, and offer him. So you've waited for the son, and he's the joy of your life. Everything you do is revolving around him now. And God tells you to go up and kill him and burn him. This is outrageous. Now, just listen to the words. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and offer him. Well, do we hear anything like that in the New Testament? Maybe John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son. And that's a preparation for what's to come, because the picture of Abraham offering his son Isaac is a prelude to another father with an only begotten son who's going to be sacrificed. And guess where Mount Moriah is? It says in the book of Chronicles that God, that Solomon built his temple on Mount Moriah. If the temple is on Mount Moriah, that means it's on the top of the hill or mountains of Jerusalem. God tells Abraham to take his son to Mount Moriah. It's a 3 days walk from Beersheba, about 50 miles to the south. So that's 50 miles is roughly 3 days of walking, 2.5 days. So Abraham has to take him, his son, to offer him as a sacrifice on the very same mountain that 2,000 years later, another father is going to offer his only begotten son. So all of a sudden, you start to see that there's something going on here. You have to scratch the surface a little bit to see what's below, because there's something that far beyond just the story of a father offering his son in the, around 1800 BC. So take your son, your only son, whom you love. By the way, that's the first time the word love is used in the Bible. In my book on Genesis, I love to find, no pun intended, I love to find places where words are used for the first time, because it's usually very significant. And this is the first time the word love is used in the Bible, not related to Adam and Eve. It's related to a father who loves his only begotten son. Guess where that's going to lead us to? So take your son, your only son, whom you love, to Mount Moriah and offer him. Now, first of all, we got to deal with the human sacrifice issue. And that is, we look at things from our perspective, that human sacrifice is an evil thing. Anybody in the modern world would say that's a horrible thing to kill your child like that. How could God ever ask you to do that? But look at in America, we have infant sacrifice. Mm-hmm. There's so many abortions going on in our country today. It's scandalous. There's no word to describe it. Americans are offering their children a sacrifice every day. They do it for their own pleasure, for their own prosperity, so that they don't have to take care of a kid. So we look at Abraham coming from a culture where there was human sacrifice, but it's happening in our country every day. So before we start feeling too superior, so back in Abraham's time, they found death pits in Ur when from his time. And a death pit was where a king or a queen would die and all of their retinue would be killed with them. Excuse me. So they found death pits where the king was in the center and up to 80 of the people who served him were around him, laid out in a ritual way so that they could join him on his travels through the afterlife. So human sacrifice wasn't something new. It was something that was part of Abraham's culture, part of his society. I think what might be happening here is that God is saying to Abraham, I'm going to give you a final test. And we know this was a test because it says that God tested Abraham. Are you served Nana, the god of the moon, back in Ur? And there was human sacrifice here. Are you willing to do for me what you would have done for Nana? Have you really adopted me as your new god? Are you willing to do for me what you would have done back in Ur for Nana, the god of the moon? I think that there's also the possibility that God is trying to give us a human story, a human experience of a father offering his son, so that we could understand in the future what he was going to have to do for us by giving his son. And maybe as God is also saying, you know, I'm going to give my son for mankind. Is there anybody on the earth that would be willing to do the same for me? Now, all of those are just speculation, and I go through more of them in my book. But I also will conclude before we let you say another word.
I'll keep going. I brought you on for a reason.
Okay. Is that I think Abraham knew he was not going to have to kill his son. God knew it for sure. It was only a test. God knew it for sure. And I think Abraham knew it too, because when they got to the mountain, he said to his son, or to the servant boys. They had two men that came along with them. He said, the lad and I, there we go again, the word lad, meaning not just an infant or a young boy. The lad and I will go up and worship God, and we will return to you.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaac said, Father, we have the wood and the fire. Now, the fire would be like a pottery pot with coals in it, because they didn't have matches. They couldn't just go start, with a lighter or matches. They would carry around a pot of burning coals, and they would have the wood, which would be a big sticks, and they brought it with them. So Isaac obviously carrying this wood enough to burn a ram, or to burn a human body. Are you kidding? That's a lot of wood. When we did this filming on our life of Abraham, I built an altar and I put wood on top of it. And I had a ram and I put the ram on top of the altar. He was alive and kicking and bellowing, but it took five of us to get him up on that altar. That ram is not going to go up there easy, which is interesting then, because Isaac is a young man who could have overpowered his old father. And it's a picture of Jesus who went to the cross willingly in obedience to his father. Isaac could have said, what are you talking about? Me get up on the altar. You want me up there? I thought we were going to kill a lamb. What? And then he binds. That's what the Jews call it. The Akidah, the binding of Isaac. So then his father bound him and put him up there. Do you think that Abraham could have got him up on that altar himself? His son is heavy. Abraham's old. Or if his son was resisting. So the whole idea is that Isaac was a willing victim, just like Jesus went like a lamb to the slaughter. But anyway, now he says, Father, where is the lamb for the sacrifice? And Abram says, God will provide the lamb, my son. In other words, I'm not going to have to kill you. God will provide a lamb for me when I get up there. Book of Hebrews chapter 11, the faith chapter, says, that even if Abraham, he considered God faithful, that even if he had killed his son, that God would raise him from the dead. So Abram went up there, I think, not in despair, but hope that God was going to provide and something was going to come out of this. So there you've got, and the word love being used there for the first time of a father for his only begotten son. And there's two lines in there that repeat themselves. And it said, and the two of them went on together. It just is heartbreaking. It draws you into the personal drama of what's going on. And then you could see God the Father walking up to Calvary with his son, and together, father and son, you walked on together. So this whole picture of Abraham offering his son Isaac is a prefigurement of what's going to happen in the future. Now, let's take it. There's so many things to say. When Isaac went up there and they, what did he carry? It says he carried the wood of the sacrifice on his back. John's gospel makes it very clear. What did Jesus carry? The wood of the sacrifice on his back. He carried the cross. And when they got to the top, it says that they found a ram with his head stuck in a thorn bush, a thicket. What was Jesus's head stuck in when he went up there? A crown of thorns. You just have to see that there's no way that this is all by chance. And the thorns, what the thorns represent, they represent the curse on the earth, because in the book of Genesis, obviously, go back a few chapters, that when Adam and Eve sinned, it said that the garden is now going to produce thorns and thistles to resist you. So the sign of the curse, Adam and Eve were not the only one that had the curse of sin, but it said that the curse also went on creation. And in Romans 8, it says that the earth, the world, groans under that curse, waiting for the redemption of the sons of God, when the earth also will be redeemed in a sense. And what was the sign of the curse? It was thorns and thistles. What was Jesus wearing on his head? He's taking not only our sins to the world, but he's also taking the curse of the earth, a representative by the thorns and crowns. And his death is also going to bring about the restoration, the redemption of creation. So all of this is bubbling under the surface there as you read the story, those short few verses of Abraham taking his son up the mountain there to offer him as a sacrifice. Now, if you bear with me, I'm going to take it a step further, because now we get to Isaac going back home. And it says that Abraham took Isaac back home. Isaac is, in a sense, raised from the dead, right? Because he didn't have to kill him, and he takes him back home. And it says that he then decides that his son needs a bride. So he sends his unnamed servant. We don't know his name. It doesn't say at this point in the story. And he sends him with 10 camels loaded with gifts, gold and fabrics and all wonderful precious stones. And he sends him back to his own people in Haran, where his brother had remained. And he was to go there and find a bride for his son Isaac from among his own people. He goes up there and he brings 10 camel loads of gifts to give to this bride and her family. And Rebecca concedes to come back. She goes to all the way back. Now, remember, that's over 600 miles you're riding on camels. And she sees Isaac in the field. It says he's meditating out in the field. And he falls in love with Rebecca. And he weds her and takes her into his tent. Very romantic story indeed. But now let's look at it from the perspective of typology. God the Father takes his son up the mountain and offers him as a sacrifice, just like Abraham did. Then God's son, Jesus, is raised from the dead, and he takes him back to heaven. Now he says, my son needs a bride. So from heaven, he sends his unnamed servant, the Holy Spirit. Doesn't have a name. He's only a description. He's holy and he's a spirit. He sends his unnamed servant back to his own people in Jerusalem, bearing 10 camels loaded with spiritual gifts. The Spirit gives the gifts to the church wherever he wills. And he calls the bride, and the bride consents to go with him. And he takes the bride back to the son, and the son falls in love with the bride, weds her, and takes her into his tent. This is a picture of Jesus Christ, who loves his church, gave his life for her, and then falls in love with that bride and brings her home to heaven with him. And in the book of Revelation said there's going to be this great marriage of the Lamb. And the Lamb is referring to Jesus wedding his church. So there, the story of Abraham offering his son and then Isaac getting a bride, all of that in the book of Genesis is pointing forward to the whole drama of salvation, where God the Father is going to offer his only begotten son whom he loves and then send his servant to bring a bride back to his son. How exciting and romantic is all of that?
Steve, I could talk to you all day. I love that. That's great stuff. Let me throw in two comments here, and then I know we're kind of running up on time. So let me lay out a few rapid fire questions after that. The two things I want to point out are, one, that further Eucharistic angle with Abraham and Isaac, where Isaac is the son who's supposed to be in him, you know, going out to become all of these peoples of the world, all these nations. He's supposed to go out into the rest of them. So through him, we get Jacob and then all of his sons, then all of the tribes, and then we are grafted into that, right? So he comes off of the altar and then he's sent out into the world to become part of all of the people of God. And we have Christ, who comes off of the altar at the Mass and is sent into all of the people of God. So we have that coming off and sending into and multiplication, right?
Yep.
And then the other thing is, you mentioned how we have God the Father with the Son going up to the cross. But I'm going to throw in one more person that you mentioned. You said that the first time love is ever spoken of is between Abraham and Isaac. So there's actually three things going up that mountain. There's the Father, there's the Son, and there's the love between them. So right. Trinitarian-wise, we understand the love between the Father and the Son is the Holy Spirit. So we have a Trinitarian picture there involved in the sacrifice.
Very nicely said. Very nicely said. And that's that. All of this, if you read the book of Genesis the way it was meant to be read, with all of the levels under the surface, so to speak, it's just like the Gospel of John. I always say that the Gospel of John is like the Sea of Galilee. Every time I take my groups, we go out on a boat on the Sea of Galilee. And if you read the Gospel of John or the book of Genesis just on the surface, it's beautiful. Read the story. It's lovely. And you, it's like the fish jumping in the water and the clouds and the shoreline and all the beautiful things. But if you put on scuba gear and you dive into the Sea of Galilee, it's a whole nother world under there. It's the same Sea of Galilee, but there's a lot you see under there that you don't see on the surface. And the book of Genesis and the book of John are the same way. They're a wonderful story on the surface, but if you put on scuba gear, like I did in my book that I wrote, and dive into those books, then you see a whole nother spiritual world under there that the Holy Spirit intended you to see, but you won't do it unless you have eyes to see and ears to hear and you take the time to study the scriptures.
The most impressive thing about your book is that you were able to stop. I don't know how anybody stops writing commentaries on Genesis. I think that's by far the difference. Well, are you ready for the rapid fire round? All of these deserve a couple hours, but
yes.
And then we'll cut it off as soon as you got to go.
Okay.
One is, one of the most strange parts in the story of Abraham is when he's put to sleep and God comes to form a covenant with him. And we have this with the torch and this pot that passes through the animals. Can you tell us why on earth does God choose to be represented as a pot and a torch? What's going on there?
Well, it's in ancient times, this was a ritual, and it was a covenant ritual. And when you killed the animals and you spread them out like that, you were saying between the parties, such will happen to me if I fail to live up to the contract or covenant I've made with you. So God is making a covenant with Abraham and basically saying, so will it be to me if I fail to give to fulfill my promises to you of this covenant. That's why he does that. You know, in a way, Israel today, when I look at the Jewish people, to me, they're a huge proof of the existence of God, because you don't find Jebusites and Hittites and Amorites anymore, but you do find the Jewish people. And there's less than 16 million of them in the whole earth. And they exist because God made this covenant with Abraham, and God kept that covenant for all generations. He said he was going to keep that covenant. And he did. When he walked among those dead animals that were spread out there, he was saying to Abraham, so will it be to me if I fail to live up to my covenant with you. This was common law of all of the nations around it. So Abraham knew exactly what we read it. It doesn't make any sense because we don't live in that culture, know the legal and contractual arrangements that people had by law. That was one of them there. And God was playing out what was already known to Abraham because of the culture he lived in.
So what about Sarah and the parallels to Mary? What are the big ones you see there?
Well, Mary had, if I asked you, who are your favorite saints? You would tell me who your saints are. Mine are Athanasius and some of the others. But if you ask Mary, who are your saints? Mary had saints. She had heroes. She built her life on those. Sarah, Eve, Elizabeth, Hannah, all of these. Miriam, guess where she got her name? Mary is not, her name is not Mary. Her name is Miriam. And she is named after Moses' sister. So Moses' sister was her hero. How many women in the New Testament do you see named Miriam? You got to roll your R's when you do that. Miriam. It's not easy for us Americans to do. But how many women in the New Testament are named Miriam? So Mary had saints. She had heroes. And Sarah obviously is one of those. The Catechism said that these ancient women of the past who were the heroes of Mary prepared the way for the Blessed Virgin Mary.
So what about circumcision? This is given to Abraham as a mark of this covenant.
What a ripoff.
What does that mean? Yeah, I know, right? He's like, I'm going to get a covenant. It's probably going to be something great.
Okay, here's the way I explain it. Just 5-6 days ago, I was in Jerusalem looking out from the promenade out over Jerusalem, and I do a talk called The Story of Salvation History from Adam and Eve Until Today. And I do it in 30 minutes because you can see the whole thing right in front of you. And I said that Abraham, he's 99 years old, and God comes and says, Abraham, I'm going to give you a sign of the covenant. And Abraham says, finally, after 25 years of wandering around, I'm finally going to get something worthwhile out of this deal. So what is the sign of this covenant, God? And he hands him a flint knife and he says, cut it off. Cut what off? The foreskin. And whenever I do this, all the men in the room kind of cross their legs. And, oh, you can hear them groan. But the thought of Abraham at 99 years old circumcising himself, and not with the kind of stainless steel knives and anesthetics that we have today, but with a flint knife, a rugged flint knife. And Abraham, I think he called his men together the next morning. He had 318 men who worked for him. And God said this was not just for Abram, but all the men of his clan. I can just hear him saying in the morning to the guys, hey, guys, God just gave us a sign of the covenant. And do you want to hear the good news first or the bad news first? But
right.
Here is the faith of Abraham. It says that the flint knife flashed the next morning and they were all circumcised.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite the sign of faith. It does seem that it's you know, that's the way by which he generates life.
Yes, that's why it's that organ.
And it's marking it with obedience and self-sacrifice. And really to sum up who Abraham was, is he's the progenitor of this spiritual life. Yep. Because God chose him, worked through him, and he is marked by obedience and self-sacrifice.
Yep. And even when he sent his servant to find a bride for Isaac, it says that he put his hand under his thigh. But everyone knows that that means that he put his hands upon his genitals, because that was the organ of procreation. And that was a solemn, you can't get any more solemn of an oath for your servant to find a bride for your son and for the future generations. And that was the way that they would play a vow. He had to place his hands there in order to swear that he would find a son for Abraham.
And the very last thing is, and boy, this one needs a book on its own, Melchizedek. What a fascinating figure.
Abraham is coming back from a battle up in Damascus where he delivered his nephew Lot from the kings from the north. And as he's coming back through the King's Valley, and I was just looking at that 5 days ago and pointing it out to the group that I had up on the promenade, there's the valley right there called the King's Valley. It's right outside the wall of Jerusalem. And it says that out from there came a very mysterious figure. There's only four verses that talk about him in Genesis. And the name of the Most High God is used four times in that passage. I think it's only used five times in the whole Bible. Four of them are in those four verses there. A unique name for God. And it says that a man named Melchizedek came out from Salem. Salem, well, maybe we could say Jerusalem. And he was called the King of Peace. That's what Jerusalem meant. And that he was a priest and a king of the Most High God. This is obviously, he is a prefiguration of Jesus Christ. And the whole of the fathers of the church and the whole early church and the catechism say that when he brought out the gift, what was it? It was an extravagant gift for Abraham and all of his men. He brought out bread and wine. He could have brought out bread and water, but he didn't. He brought out bread and wine, a very extravagant gift. And Abram, representing the people of God, gave him 10% or a tithe. And we gave that to Melchizedek because we were in the loins of Abraham at the time, because we're the sons of Abraham by faith. So in a sense, when he did it, all of us did it through his loins, in the sense of his descendants. And we gave him 10%, the tithe, and he, being the Lord, gave back a gift of bread and wine. And I say that Jerusalem has been a very Eucharistic city for 4,000 years.
Awesome. Yeah, there, you know, even you're talking about the tradition of the Christian tradition, Philo of Alexandria, who's a Jew, right? He talks about Melchizedek, describing him as being the Logos, and that his inheritance is the Most High God. So there's some tradition that this is Shem, some tradition which gets pulled into the book of Hebrews that says, actually, he doesn't have a mother or a father.
Yeah, very strange.
Generation, right?
But he is a picture of Jesus Christ. And the fact is that Jesus Christ comes from Joseph, who is from the tribe of Judah. Judah is the tribe of the kings, not the tribe of the priests. Judah is the tribe of the kings. Joseph, Jesus inherits that through being adopted by Joseph. So he is of the kingly tribe. He is not of the tribe of Aaron. So how could Jesus be a high priest, which had to come from Aaron, because Book of Hebrews said, oh, it's much better than that. He comes from the tribe, he comes from the priesthood of Melchizedek, which predates and prefigures Aaron the high priest. Now I'll throw a little monkey wrench in here. I think that Jesus did have the blood of Aaron in him as well, because who is Mary a relative of? Elizabeth. And, Zachariah and Elizabeth are 100% pure blood Aaronic priesthood. So if Mary is their close relative, my guess is that Mary had the blood of the high priest, so that Jesus then would have been a descendant of the priestly and the kingly line.
Wow. And, you know, David also is a priest king. So you have Melchizedek, priest king. David's a priest king.
Yep.
And then so David ends up, and Solomon, priest king. And what I particularly like is when David goes into to eat the bread only for priests, it's because he's out on mission. You know, he's going defeating evil. And we see a lot of Christ's priesthood is about simultaneously going to war against evil.
Yep. Very good. Well,
let's wrap it up here. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm sure everybody would has appreciate the stuff that you shared. I know I did, and there's so much more in the book. So I will remind people to get that. It is in the show notes, both the link to your website and the book. Is there anything else you'd like to let the listeners know?
Well, I would just say, Jake, I find you very biblically and Catholically astute. And it was a pleasure talking with you. A lot of times people I talk to have very little knowledge of the Bible and so on. They're maybe a broadcaster or an interviewer, but I find you to be very astute, and I enjoyed the conversation very much. I know this is probably not a great time to invite people to come to Israel with me with the bat or the fighting going on over there, but you know, this is something that happens all the time in Israel. And I've been, you know, dealing with this for 20, I've been to Israel over 200 times, and this will quiet down and be over shortly. And I do have a lot of trips coming up to Israel in the next few months and years. And if you want to see Israel the way, the Holy Land, the way a Catholic should see it, join us, because I love nothing more than showing people the land.
See, I want to take you up on that too.
I'd love to. You, oh boy, goodness, you of all people, you would love this, because I do typology all through. When we get to the Garden of Gethsemane, that's a garden. When we get to Mount of Transfiguration, that's a mountain. You got to think Mount Sinai. Everywhere we go, I do the typology of the Old and New Testaments together, and people just are so excited.
Awesome. That's one thing I'd love to have a chat with you, maybe down the line or later. Which is non-Jesus typologies through scripture. I find fascinating.
Yep.
Everybody ignores those, but yeah, I think they're really cool. All right. Well,
good talking with you, Jake.
Thank you so much. Yep. All right.
You're welcome. God bless. Bye-bye.
You too.